Good morning and welcome to the final convocation of the current academic year. The Roman poet Horace advised authors with these words, "Follow tradition, or if you invent, see that your characters be congruent." I'm happy to introduce today an author who, in his historical novels, has been following that advice in his own special way. Dr. Paul L. Meyer is our speaker this morning. Dr. Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University and campus chaplain to the Lutheran students there. He's no stranger, of course, to this campus, being an erstwhile resident not too far from here and also a 1955 graduate of the seminary. In addition, he has an MA from Harvard University and a PhD from the University of Basel in Switzerland. Many of you, no doubt, have read some or all of his earlier historical novels, Pontius Pilate, The First Christmas, First Easter, The First Christians, and more recently, The Flames of Rome. He informs me he is also a co-editor on a currently appearing commentary on Josephus. Also especially precious to us in these circles are his biography of his father, Dr. Walter A. Meyer, A Man Spoke, A World Listened, and the anthology of his father's writings, The Best of Walter A. Meyer. Dr. Meyer's topic today is the Greco-Roman perspective in biblical studies, and in the face of the tide of recent biblical studies from the perspective of Judaica, I'm sure you agree with me that it is important for us to hear what applications to the New Testament are made by a classicist and a historian of the Roman age. So therefore, join me in welcoming and in paying eager attention to Dr. Paul Meyer.
Thank you. Gee, you really make a person feel at home here. Boy, talk about a homecoming. This is a double homecoming for me because not only did I graduate in the great class of 1955 along with Manny Jansen and others, but I grew up on this campus in North Seminary Terrace. The first 20 years of my life were spent here, so this is truly a homecoming. And I went to chapel this morning, and I was really delighted to see these fellas line up. I was afraid it was an excommunication ceremony, but that wouldn't have been too appropriate. I could spend the next hour alone regaling you about Concordia Seminary in times yore, about what, you know, coming of age at Concordia was like, and what the students thought of us in those days, profs, kids, something like the 11th plague of Egypt, after the boils and the hail and the darkness came the prof's kids. We were less reverent in those days. Dr. Walter's first seminary there used to have a bell tower next to it, but they took it down primarily because we were ringing the bell at all hours of the night, usually 2 or 3 in the morning. When we say we know this campus from the bottom up, we mean quite literally, because one of the prof's kids got a hold of a pass key and we used the steam tunnels underneath this complex of buildings to infest the place years ago, especially when we'd torment the students or set off skyrockets in the quadrangle during final examinations. I hope there are no prof's kids present so we don't give them any ideas, but we were an unregenerate crew back in those days, we really were. Forgive us the sins of our youth. This morning, then, I had breakfast over here, and I eagerly looked to see if grape nuts were available, and they were not. And I'll tell you why. This is according to the really historical, critical tradition here. We'll tell you why there are no grape nuts. Because of the great grape nuts caper in 1936. That's why. Walt, my brother, and I... Now, I don't want to justify Walt at this point. He can handle... I'm not sure I could speak objectively on the issue. Anyway, Walt and I went over to the chief dietitian at the seminary. Her name was Ma Powers. And in 1936, the CW Post Company of Battle Creek, Michigan, came across with a great grape nuts offer, whereby if you had enough grape nuts tops, you could buy catcher's mitt, tennis racket, microscope, chemistry set, and all these good things. Usually the combination was 4 grape nuts flakes box tops and $3 for the catcher's mitt, or 20, you know, box tops. Always that option of letting it all be box tops. So we went over to the chief dietitian, and we told her about the value, vitamins and otherwise, included in grape nuts. And for the next 8 weeks, the only breakfast cereal allowed was grape nuts. We got all the box tops, and we sent hundreds of them to Battle Creek. And every 3 weeks, we got this cargo of goodies. Tennis rackets for everybody on the block, baseball mitts, catchers, and so forth. And that's the reason that you folks have since been phased out of grape nuts. Back in those days, there were two very famous Karl Barths in the world. One was much less famous as far as we were concerned. He was a rather insignificant Swiss theologian writing things like Raymer Brief and that kind of thing. The Karl Barth we knew, of course, was the tennis ace out in the tennis courts there. And since then, he's gone on to other things, I understand. The Greco-Roman perspective in biblical studies should actually, apologies to John here, be entitled the Greco-Roman Judaic Hellenistic perspective to biblical studies, or to put it much more briefly, the extra-biblical approach to biblical studies. This may sound unusually strange to go at studying the Bible by not using it directly, but by using instead the encrustation of literature from the environment. But I'm convinced that not enough of this has been done in our church or in the Christian church in general, because we have a tremendously rich amount of material outside the Bible, which, as you know, relates directly inside it. I came across this quite by accident, I suppose. It was a professional accident. I should tell you where I'm coming from. I am not only professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University, but also campus chaplain to Lutheran students. Does this mean that I'm moonlighting? Two jobs? No, it's worse than that. It's out in the open. I'm sunlighting. The case, am I getting two salaries? Yes, but two substandard salaries equal one normal salary. Is this mixing church and state? Yes, I suppose it is. If Madeline Murray O'Hare heard about me, she'd probably have a stroke, which in itself wouldn't be too bad an idea. But actually, this has given me a unique opportunity to keep from doing the personal splits by anchoring one foot, in fact, in both disciplines. One squarely in the New Testament, and the other in the extra-biblical literature and archaeology, which, of course, addresses itself to this corner of the world. I think tremendously valuable lessons are lost because there aren't freaks like myself who try to bridge the two disciplines. And I think well, first of all, let's talk about sources. Where in the world do we get new light on the old story, that presumptuous title? You all know, I'm sure, about the extra-biblical materials that never got inside the Bible but almost might have had they been inspired, like Josephus's Wars and Antiquities, like the writings of Philo Judaeus, the Jewish philosopher of Alexandria, so directly in touch with the story that he could have rubbed elbows with Jesus at any one of the Passover festivals in Jerusalem. You know, I'm sure, about the rabbinical traditions that mention Jesus. And then, of course, the rich and detailed resources we have in Greco-Roman history and literature, all of which can be made, if you search hard enough, to impinge quite directly on some of the episodes, on some of the very personalities that you find inside the Bible. Beyond that, of course, is archaeology, which is, of course, unscheduled. You can't tell what the good earth is going to produce at a given dig. But since more archaeology is taking place over there, I think per acre than anywhere on earth, before you people pass on, there will be additional extremely valuable finds that will impinge on the Bible, Old and New Testament, or they may not. They may be perfectly oblique to it. But time and again where they do impinge, you know the affirmation ratio is extremely strong. So I congratulate you on choosing your generation and your parents to be born in this particular era. It's a tremendous time to be alive for Christians. The fact is that I'm sure all your professors would agree, we know far more about the New Testament world in which Jesus lived and died and rose again than our great father in the faith, Martin Luther, could possibly have known 500 years ago. More than St. Thomas Aquinas could have known, quite probably more even than St. Augustine could have known. That is how privileged we are today, I think, to use these resources. And my suggestion is simply, well, we ought then to go and use them. There are two reasons that I say we ought to. First of all, for the purpose of Christian apologetics. And secondly, because it's just fun and games to do it. It is just fun to get a new dimension on some of these biblical stories and episodes, to tell what Paul Harvey calls the rest of the story behind the story, to get a better dimensional view. Those are the two benefits, I think. Let me simply illustrate what I mean by those two benefits. When you go out in the world, you'll find that if you take on an atheist somewhere or a good, knowledgeable agnostic, one of the primary arguments he'll throw in your face is, quote, if Jesus is so all-fired important, how come his name is not mentioned in any first century sources outside the Bible? You would be shocked to find that 9 out of 10 Christians would respond to that by saying, well, the Bible's enough. That's all we need. Now, that's a fine theological answer. I'm not going to quarrel with it. But it's a terrible answer to that question because the question itself does not compute. If you misprogram a computer, you put garbage in and you get garbage out. And this question itself is garbage. Don't try to answer a question which is not phrased properly. Who says the name of Jesus doesn't show up in materials outside the New Testament? It does. Once when I made that point, an atheist from Florida wrote me after an article I had in Saturday Review. And he said, if you can name any of your famous sources, I'll give you or any charity you name $1,000. So I gave him 6. And I asked him to make the check preferably for $6,000 payable to the Lutheran Student Center in Kalamazoo, which is my favorite charity. Needless to say, I never heard from him again. But let's just take one of those sources as a case in point. Rabbinical traditions in Sanhedrin 43a, where Yeshua HaNotzri is mentioned, Jesus the Nazarene. That's what they called him in those days. And it's the reason, by the way, that the Ozzy Hoffman special, which is finally going to come out next year, this documentary in the life of Christ, is going to be called Yeshua instead of the Israelite, which I think was a lousy name for it anyway. Yeshua is better. All right, the rabbinical tradition says, and this really is a rest notice, you know. It says, he shall be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and has led Israel to apostasy. And if you know of his whereabouts, tell a great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. Now, this is a case of where we have definitely the same Jesus. There were a lot of Jesuses in those days, but we know this is the fellow, for sure. And you may say, oh, well, wait a minute. That doesn't accord very well at all with the Bible, does it? Jesus was crucified and not stoned. Oh, yes, it does. Again, you got to get back to the Zitz im Leben. You got to see what's happening here. This is their viewpoint as to why they want Jesus hung up. And do you realize if you want to torpedo Jesus, the chances in any given year are 51 out of 52 that if you as the priestly establishment over there catch him, you will stone him to death, not crucify him. Why 51 out of 52 chances? Because Pontius Pilate is only in Jerusalem during the Passover week. Otherwise, he's at Caesarea, the Roman provincial capital. They didn't know when they were going to arrest Jesus. And so by the law of averages alone, they say he's going to be stoned. And look at the riches of this one line in the rabbinical tradition. He has practiced sorcery. That's fabulous. Why? You know, sometimes I'm asked, is there any way to prove miracles outside the Bible? Well, you can't prove them, but boy, you get some fascinating straws in the wind. Here's one of them. Jesus evidently is really doing something there in these things called miracles that's visible, it's objective, that his enemies can see. They don't like it. But the way they try to tear it down is say Jesus is getting help from below, sorcery, not help from above, miracles. See? This is the kind of thing you would expect to see in the extra-biblical materials if something extraordinary is going on over there. So there's a one-liner. It just shows you the wealth of applicable data here as regards to the life of Christ. And then for other people, you have a whole congeries of episodes that are not recorded in the Bible. This is why I got hung up on Pontius Pilate. We know 7 times as much about Pontius Pilate from materials outside the New Testament as the famous Good Friday event. 7 times as much. And in the big debate that currently is waged over, you know, responsibility for Good Friday and is the Sanhedrin involved or isn't it, you all know about the controversy that's raged for the last 10, 15 years on Jewish responsibility in Good Friday and how they're trying to rewrite the Passion story and how they accuse all the 4 Gospels of being hopelessly anti-Semitic and how there are cries to rewrite the New Testament on that basis and re-edit it. And how the story's getting skewed. How come nobody has bothered using what I like to call God's backup systems, these extra-biblical resources? If you're going to talk about Pilate, or if you want to change his role, how come nobody does his homework to look up this guy and see what else we know about the guy to help figure out why he's acting so strangely on Good Friday? He's acting strangely, I'll grant that. But there's a reason for it. Instead, our critics can come across with these marvelous reconstructions, like Menachem Begin in his last visit to Jimmy Carter in Washington. Remember Jimmy Carter? 700-page book called The Trial and Death of Jesus. 150 pages of footnotes, therefore very scholarly. The thesis in this book is that Annas and Caiaphas, far from being Jesus' opponents, were really his dear friends who were trying to keep him out of trouble with that dirty bird Pontius Pilate. And so the Gospels are hopeless, in other words. The real story, folks, if you want to know it in Holy Week, is the Romans are out to get Jesus, and the Sanhedrin may even be trying to defend him. Now, why do they try to rewrite the story this way? The logic is really interesting. Let's say you're trying to launch the Christian church in Rome, okay? Here you are, you're in Vicarage, you're your first call, you're going down the Appian Way, knocking on doors, right? And I don't know what your opening line is, hi, we're taking a religious census, or, you know, and so forth. But you say, we'd like you to join this new Christian church in the catacombs at the edge of town. And they say, what's Christian, Gaius says, you know. And you say, well, Christian refers to a Jesus Christ who was crucified as a common criminal by one of your Roman governors. You know, slam. The equivalent would be a guy going from door to door in the dorms here saying that he wants to start a new cult in the SEM steam tunnels or something, in honor of Charles Manson, the mass murderer in California. I mean, you wouldn't call a night watchman, you'd call the Clayton sheriff. So what you do is sweeten the message. Sweeten it a little bit by changing it. See, the Roman governor really wants to get Jesus, but now let's say he was pressured into it by the Jews, see? And so add this to the stupidity of the medieval church, which blamed the Jews collectively for Good Friday, see? And then the mea culpa today, the nostra culpa. We never should have done that, obviously. But that all is mixed up now into theological chic today, as your professors will tell you, is that you really got to take all the Gospels with a grain of salt when it comes to the Passion story. Pilate couldn't have done this. Couldn't have acted that way. I give you Rosemary Ruther. The picture of Pilate deigning to argue with the crowd is ludicrous, she writes. If Pilate were convinced of his innocence, as the Gospels say, he would have marched Jesus north up to Nazareth, and that would have been the end of it, under an honor guard. And that's when somebody like myself hits the ceiling, because they have not done their homework. They have not involved the episode of the golden Roman shields to account for Pilate's conduct on Good Friday. Now you may say, what's that? Never saw that in any CPH materials. It's only an eyewitness account from Philo himself of Alexandria, contemporaneous with Pontius Pilate. He was there, and he writes about it in his famous embassy to Caligula. He tells about Pilate hanging up a couple of golden shields in his office in Jerusalem about a year before Good Friday, is the best chronology we can give to this. Now, these shields had no images on them. Pilate had his fingers burned on that one earlier, the episode of the Roman standards. These had no images. All it was were a couple of blank shields with an inscription at the edge, dedicated to Tiberius Caesar, given by Pontius Pilate, the equivalent of the governor of Missouri having not only a state flag in his office in Jefferson City, but an American flag as well. It's a token pledge of allegiance to the central regime. Philo tells us that Pilate next day got a visit from Herod Antipas, the one who killed John the Baptist, and his brothers. And Herod wants those shields taken down. Pilate stands his ground, doesn't take them down because he knows what Herod is doing to him. Herod wants Pilate's job so bad he can taste it. He's in charge only of Galilee. He wants Judea and Samaria as well so that he can be like dear old dad. You know, the Herod of the Christmas story, have all of Palestine under his control. So Josephus tells us that Herod is constantly, he's tattling on everybody over there. He talks about, he's trying to play leapkind, I guess we'd say brownie, as far as the emperor is concerned, constantly reporting on everything going on there. And in this case, he's trying to trap Pilate, put Pilate in a no-win situation. If Pilate takes the shields down, off goes a letter to Rome saying, "Dear Tiberius, your governor just took down his pledge of allegiance to you. I wonder what this means." If he left the shields hanging, "Dear Tiberius, your governor just doesn't have the right touch. He's managed to antagonize us in an area concerning our religion," or something nebulous like that. Pilate did the right thing, didn't take him down. 5 months before Good Friday, as best we can conclude on the basis of ancient mail service in winter or summer, Pilate gets this letter in nasty Latin from Tiberius, showing that Antipas had finked on him after all, behind his back, written to Rome, and Pilate is warned to take down those blankety-blank shields, and Pilate, from now on, you are on probation. Don't manage to antagonize those Jewish people in any manner affecting their religious sensitivities, because you will have outlived your usefulness in Judea if you do. You want to know what's hanging over Pilate's head on Good Friday? You want to know why he's acting strangely? You want to know why he feels pressured by the mob? You want to know why he can't simply release Jesus? Clear. The episode of the Golden Roman Shields. It comports perfectly with the New Testament account and explains his attitude. And as far as Annas and Caiaphas are concerned, the Jewish rabbinical traditions themselves mention them. And the Jews don't like them either. Woe to the house of Annas, woe to their serpent-like hisses. And in case you want to exonerate the Sanhedrin entirely, I give you the case of James, Bishop of Jerusalem, half-brother of Jesus of Nazareth, who, 32 years after Good Friday, was in a stunning parallel situation. In the absence of the Roman governor, the Pilate figure, the high priest and the Sanhedrin stoned this guy to death for Christianity. 62 AD. Now, it's a conclusive parallel. Later, when the Roman governor, the Pilate figure, in this case his name was Albinus, when he shows up, he's so ticked off at that arrogant, that lynching, on the Stephen model, that he canned the high priest. So the picture of a Roman governor being somewhat protective of an aberrant Jewish sect called the Christiani, see, to avoid violence like this, and the Sanhedrin as advocating violence, is perfectly endorsed one generation later. Now, does this mean I'm a great big anti-Semite because of what happened on Good Friday and blaming it all on the Jews? No, of course not. I'm going to have an article about 5 months from now in Christianity Today in which I look at it from a viewpoint that nobody seems to have thought of, and that's demographics. That's stratification of society. I can prove to you, I think, that if a plebiscite were held at Good Friday noon with one question on it, shall Jesus live or die, and every Jew in Jerusalem had a right to vote, Jesus would have won life by about 80% of the vote. You got all the Passover pilgrims there voting. You got Jesus' obvious popularity growing during Holy Week, not diminishing people. And please, when you get out in the ministry, don't use this famous line, oh, the fickle crowd that could yell Hosanna to the Son of David on Palm Sunday and crucify him on Good Friday. I know, we've all used it. Different crowd, folks, different crowd. I'm not saying that, you know, nobody changed his mind on Jesus, but I'm saying that it is the temple establishment in Jerusalem which is primarily responsible. Annas, Caiaphas and the boys, the Levites, the sacrifice people, the priestly establishment, the temple guards, you add them all together, Josephus tells us there were 10,000 running the temple. You want a lynch mob? You want somebody to come along that can be perfectly orchestrated to ask for Barabbas or Jesus? You got it. There it is. But it's patently stupid ever to have collectively blamed the Jews. Now that's the way out of anti-Semitism, not trying to rewrite the New Testament Gospels. You know, Josephus, you can prove to your parishioners, by the way, how they've all used a little bit of Josephus without them knowing it. I've proved to you, too. If I would ask you to tell me the story of how John the Baptist was executed, you would tell me about Herod Antipas' birthday party and Herodias coming along with that floor show, right? Her daughter doing the dance of traditionally the seven veils and all that. Okay, what's the gal's name? Salome, right. But I challenge you to find her name in the Gospels. You won't. You'll find Salome as one of the gals who came out to the Easter tomb. Different Salome, I tend to think, or... we really have an example of personality transformation. Nope, Josephus tells us the same account, pinpoints it to Machaerus, the fortress of Herod the Great at the northeastern end of the Dead Sea, just opposite from Masada, which is also Josephus' work, as you know, and names the girl. So it shows you this valuable interplay between these sources in the New Testament. Hey, this thing I just told you about, the episode of the Golden Shields, explains that verse in Luke, which has no commentary otherwise in the New Testament. The verse I'm referring to is when Jesus is sent over to the tribunal of Herod Antipas during the Good Friday process, remember? And Pilate is clever. He's killing two birds with one stone. He's getting rid of this religious case that he doesn't want to handle. And he's mending diplomatic fences with this fellow who's constantly tattling on him. Wave an olive branch. Maybe he'll shut up. So that's the reason Jesus goes over there. Herod, of course, wants a magic show and sends Jesus back. But then there's that one verse in Luke. And Herod and Pilate were made friends that same day because before this they had been hostile with one another. I submit the New Testament does not tell us why they were hostile, but the episode of the Golden Roman Shields does tell us why they were hostile and why they were now friends. And so there once again is a perfect example of the extra-biblical material meshing perfectly with the New Testament and really explaining it. Even the way Jesus was crucified has come under critical attack. You may remember the late, not-so-great Bishop Pike, that postgraduate Christian, who was off in Palestine doing research on another put down in the life of Christ, and he was going, his big climax was to disprove that they ever nailed Jesus to the cross. He says they tied him to the cross because human flesh is too fragile, wouldn't tolerate a nail. A nail would wiggle out in the webbing between the fingers. And supposedly they even proved it once. I don't know who lent himself to the experiment of... Christians used to be sensitive on that. They used to say, well, it's true if you take even a 60-penny spike, human flesh is pretty fragile here, and they put it in the wrist instead of the palms. See, that was the standard way out. Well, rejoice, Christians, you don't have to use any way out anymore because the archaeology is in. About a dozen years ago, a bulldozer was working its way through northeastern Jerusalem. I should point out that a bulldozer is not your average archaeological tool. This one was doing a housing development and scraped open the side of a hill, and there they found a collection of ossuaries, stone bone chests, kind of a space-saving way to bury people in those days, one-by-one-by-three-foot chests that have some dead people in their bones. And one of these victims was named Yochanan ben Hagalgol, John the son of Galgal. There's no reference to him in Josephus or Philo or anybody else, so we don't know who he was. But the archaeology shows that he was between 28 and 34, that he had a triangular face, had good teeth, had a cleft palate, and he was crucified by nailing because there's a hole in the distal end of his right radius bone. Both of his legs broken below the kneecap. I mean, that's just perfect confirmation on what they did to the malefactors on each side of Jesus on Good Friday to induce death. It's standard operating procedure for crucifixion, evidently. And then 7 inches worth of spike still lodged in his heel bones. Now, this was widely publicized a dozen years ago or so. You probably all know about it. But what most of the reports failed to mention was the physics of it all. How do you hold fragile flesh on the cross with a spike? Well, right beneath the head of the nail, they found the rotting remains of acacia wood, the wood they used for building the tabernacle. And obviously this was the secret. It was a washer, a plaque, a wedge that they used. So the procedure is first the spike goes into this washer to increase the area that the head can hold. Then that whole affair, thumbtack-like, went on the victims. I don't care. Wrist, palm, makes no difference. This fellow happened to get it in the wrist. A perfect confirmation on what they did to Jesus. And so there's no longer any debate anywhere with any scholar who's up in the literature. Yes, Virginia, they nailed people to the cross. It's quite clear. There it is. So I had a lot of fun with this Christmas and Easter and Christians book project. These are not novels. These are only the facts and the documentation. I put photographs of that victim's bones in my Easter book so that Spike and all the critics could get the point. Then I went out on a limb. Went out on a limb as far as Easter's concerned. I really tried to use this method to see if we could go shed new light on the Easter phenomenon. Most Christians assume, again, that every last detail about what happened on the third day is locked in at the tail end of the four Gospels, and that's all. You believe them or you don't, and that's it. And there's no way for something as extraordinarily supernatural as this to ever be attested to by anything on the outside. Wrong. Now, to be sure, I cannot use this method to prove, quote-unquote, the resurrection. If I could, it would be simple. I'd have a bestseller for the next 10,000 years. The whole world would have to go Christian if it could read. It'd be very simple. God doesn't want it that way. It eliminates this item called faith. But hold it, people. There are two discrete phenomena that took place on Easter Sunday morning. One, Jesus rose from the dead. Two, as a result of that resurrection, the tomb must have been empty, right? Yeah, okay. Empty tomb. That we can prove. Now you're going to say, come on, how can you prove an empty tomb? I can prove it on the basis of non-biblical materials alone. Now, of course, the critics used to say, oh, come on, the early church doesn't talk much about the empty tomb and so forth. They're not interested in it. Of course they're not. Who cares about the empty tomb? In the sense of, you get a letter from your sweetheart or so, what counts, the letter or the envelope? The empty tomb is the envelope of the resurrection. The empty tomb is the husk, the shell of the resurrection, not the meat, the kernel, the core. So the early church is thrilled to have a risen Christ, doesn't care about the empty tomb. Nevertheless, from the point of view of secular history, we have some fascinating material on the empty tomb. Now, I don't know why we didn't learn about that here at 801 Diman, but I came across it in the Jewish rabbinical traditions, and I just about shot off another skyrocket. I couldn't believe this, that in the Jewish traditions themselves, in whose interest it would be to shut up about anything connected with Easter, or even to fib about it, they admit an empty tomb. Now, you're all familiar with the one standard demonstration of the empty tomb, which is terrific, which has never, ever been contradicted in 1900 years, and you should continue to use it. It's the one argument that even the German higher critics have a lot of trouble with. And Pannenberg and others will use it positively. And that is the argument of the origin of Christianity, that Christianity developed only one place in this globe, you know, not even regionally. There's one city alone where it first started as the kerygma of the resurrection, and that's the city of Jerusalem. And, of course, the argument is from circumstantial evidence. There, least of all, could the faith have ever begun if the moldering body of Jesus of Nazareth were available in the disputes that followed the apostolic preachment after Easter. You know, the first chapters in Acts are full of this stuff about how Caiaphas trying to keep him shut up, put him in prison, in and out. He wouldn't have done any of this if Jesus' body were available. He'd have conducted a little stroll over to Joseph's tomb, kicked the stone aside, there it is. Behold, it's the end of Christianity. We wouldn't be here today under these circumstances. Period. And it's true. There simply is no way of opposing that argument, and it still is a very tremendously strong argument for the empty tomb. But I add to that now what I call positive testimony and a hostile source. This is what you call self-authenticating testimony. It's something rare for an ancient historian to find this kind of thing, because in so many historical statements, especially from 2,000-3,000 years ago, we have to, you know, adjust for the bias of the source. We have to see what else is going on. We have to see, you know, is Josephus primping up the Jews too much? Yes, at many places he is, and so forth. And so it's very difficult to find a statement that proves itself. But when you find a datum, which is what in court is called an admission against interest in the legal profession, you know, where you bring something out in court and both sides have to agree to it because it's patent, it's obvious. If you lie about that, even if it hurts your case, everybody know you're lying about something else too, maybe, so you have to admit it. That's what positive testimony and hostile source is. And so when in the rabbinical traditions themselves, you have various versions of Easter trickling down, even to a version of Judah, the gardener, who had snuck the body out of his tomb and buried it elsewhere and wants 30 pieces of silver from the high priest and he'll tell him where the body is. You know, garbled versions. This, I find, is a fascinating, interesting, and almost direct confirmation of the empty tomb phenomenon. There's even some archaeology to bear. It doesn't prove anything, but boy, when you add up all these straws in the wind, it's really wild. You have the Nazareth inscription of Claudius warning against grave robbery or breaking seals. You got to remember, all these rabbinical traditions don't say Jesus rose from the dead. They all say the body was stolen, which is great. All we're trying to prove is an empty tomb, folks. They may not even say the tomb was empty, but they said the body was stolen. So what is that, folks, but an empty tomb? QED. Now, I went out on a professional limb when the Easter book was published, arguing purely from the point of view of ancient history that the tomb was empty. I expected to get clobbered across the world. I did not. It's not that it didn't go public. The argument was bald and patent and public because Lou Cassells, the United Press International religion writer, took my empty tomb argument and used that for his Easter column across the states and across the world for the newspapers. And the book itself was syndicated in about 200 daily newspapers. So the argument is out, and I have challenged, you know, other scholars that if they can find in the first four centuries A.D. any reference from any source that the tomb was still occupied on Sunday morning, I want to know about it because then I'll gladly eat crow. But I have not found it.